Elite of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the elites in the Muslim world bear responsibility to pressure their government to sever all ties with Israel. Israel strikes take more civilian lives in Gaza, this time in Dar al-Balah. The total death toll from the genocide is almost 27,500. And a senior Yemeni official has stressed that Sana'a will continue to support the Palestinian people despite airstrikes against the country by the U.S. and the U.K. Hello and welcome live from Tehran. You've tuned to World News. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. First Story takes us right here to Iran this hour, where the leader of the Islamic Revolution says elites in the Muslim world have a duty to push their governments to sever ties with Israel. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says enemies are trying to prevent the elite from assuming their growing role in the society in this regard. The leader added that negligence of the elite would result in heavy blows to the nation. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks while meeting with the Air Defense Force commanders. The meeting came ahead of the anniversary of a key event before the fruition of the Islamic Revolution in Iran. On February the 8th, 1979, and 3 days before the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran's Air Force personnel met with the founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, in Tehran. Political commentator Fra Hughes says regional countries need to have a change of policy in order to stop the genocide in Gaza.
I think what he is saying is what's being said by every individual that has a heart and has humanity and a moral compass, and that is no one as an individual, as a member of a state, as a government, or as a leader should show any solidarity with the Israeli genocidal attack upon the people of Gaza. I would echo his comments. We've seen tens of millions of people globally out marching, calling for an end to the war on Gaza and demanding an end to the genocidal atrocities of the Zionist Israeli regime. And the most important thing to come out of this from the people is hopefully a change in governmental policies within the region.
Iran says attacks by the U.S. and Britain on regional countries are clumsy attempts to divert people's attention from the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. A foreign ministry spokesman said in his weekly presser that Washington is clearly trying to give Israel a free rein in continuing its genocide against Palestinians. Nasser Kanani added that the U.S. and Britain claim they do not want any escalation in the region, but their attacks on Yemen, Iraq, and Syria, and their support for the Israeli genocide disprove such claims. Kanani also said that Washington and London prefer to choose Israel over peace and stability in the West Asia region. The spokesman noted that the only sustainable solution to the crisis in the region is stopping the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Reacting to the recent U.S. threat of military action against Iran, Kanani warned that Iran would not hesitate to respond in case of a U.S. attack on its territory. Israeli bloodshed continues in Gaza as more Palestinians lose their lives in fresh air and artillery strikes. At least 30 more civilians were killed in Israeli shelling in the central city of Dar al-Balah during the past 24 hours. There was also a drone attack on an area in the center of Gaza City, which claimed the lives of 3 more people. Elsewhere in that city, 4 other Palestinians were killed after a residential building was bombed. According to a European NGO, roughly 110,000 Palestinians have been reportedly killed, missing, or injured in Gaza since Israel launched its bombing campaign on October the 7th. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor also says around 90% of the entire population of Gaza has been displaced in almost 4 months. The death toll from Israel's genocidal war stands at nearly 27,500. Well, earlier correspondent in Gaza, Moti Abu Musabeh, was with us and brought us updates from Gaza City. Here's what he had to say.
actually another massacre unfolded over the last 24 hours after the Israeli warplanes attacked several residential areas in Deir el-Balah city particularly and Al-Zawaida neighborhood. Those airstrikes actually hit and bombed several residential buildings and houses, leaving at least 37 Palestinian civilians dead over those continuous airstrikes. And in the meantime, as we speak right now, the Israeli occupation forces attacked the center of Deir el-Balah city. According to multiple eyewitnesses, just moments ago, that the Israeli occupation forces opened their gunfire towards the Palestinian civilians from the central area who are trying to return to their neighborhoods in the eastern parts of Al Burj, a refugee camp. Several Palestinian casualties were reported over that gunfire. Apparently, we are in front of more intensified attacks of the Israeli occupation forces. And let me say that when it comes to Deir el-Balah city and Rafah city, any Israeli attack hitting any Palestinian residential building or any house in those areas means massacres, means a lot of Palestinian casualties would be left behind those attacks, because those cities are completely overwhelmed and overcrowded with the displaced Palestinian civilians who fled their houses and their residential neighborhoods and buildings from Gaza City and the northern parts of Gaza Strip. In Khan Yunis City, 14 Palestinian civilians were killed over the last couple of hours as the Israeli occupation forces maintain their attacks.
Meanwhile, Israeli forces have shot a 14-year-old Palestinian boy in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Quds over an alleged stabbing attempt. Mona Candela, our correspondent Ramallah, brings us more.
14-year-old Wadia Shadir Wissat from Jabal al-Mukabbir town inside Al-Quds arrived at the junction of Baale Adumim near the settlement of Baale Adumim and near the checkpoint of Baale Adumim. The Israelis claimed that he had a knife and that he tried to stab one of the Israeli soldiers there at the Baale Adumim junction near the Palestinian town of Al-Izariyyah in Al-Quds. This Palestinian minor was shot and killed immediately, of course, as the images came from their show. A Palestinian minor had been shot and was laying on the ground with the Israeli forces, of course, preventing anyone to help him or even to bring any ambulances to transfer him to hospital. So that's why we are saying it's a murder. Every time the Israeli forces claim that a Palestinian tried to carry out an anti-Israeli operation, even before he carried out an Israeli operation, the response would be to use their guns to shoot and kill this Palestinian instead of arresting him, interrogating him, and if he's guilty, as they claim, would be detained. At the same time, we have to say that Palestinians continue to face different forms of aggression, and this is the Israeli policy. And even if the Palestinians, as the Palestinian human rights organizations and the powers are saying, Palestinians have the right to defend themselves, to defend their lands, and the Israelis' presence is illegal. Since the 7th of October, we are speaking about 382 Palestinians were shot and killed by the Israeli forces and the settlers, the majority by the Israeli forces here in the occupied West Bank.
The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has launched new retaliatory operations against Israeli military base. Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Lebanon, joins us now. Mariam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the latest information that you have about the situation.
Well, Hezbollah has launched at least three different operations specifically today on the occupied Lebanese Shabah farms. We have two operations in Sumaqa, another operation in Waisat al-Alam, and these are the posts that are constantly actually targeted by Hezbollah. And it seems also that lately Hezbollah has been focusing its attention on the Lebanese occupied Shabah farms posts and the barracks, whether those that are evident in the hills of the Shabah farms, or behind that even with newly situated posts that the Israelis have just put forth as a result of the fact that they are continuously on to target by the resistance. The Israelis, of course, have continued to target Lebanese towns, whether through artillery or warplanes. We have artillery fire that reached Tar Harfa, Zabqin, Shabain, Shabah, and Harkub. And Naqoura, we also have a lot of shelling from warplanes that have bombed also the towns of Naqoura, Barashit, and Shaheen. And here I want to mention that the town of Barashit, for example, is somewhere basically further off. It was one of the towns that is not adjacent to the border. And so the Israelis seem to be extending their operations and their aggression further off from the border. We also have new threats that have been issued by the Israeli officials, although the threats are not new. We've heard from day one the Israelis on a daily basis threatening that they will launch a full-scale war against Lebanon, despite the differences and the rift among the officials in the Israeli regime. But of course, these threats, they are not new on one hand, but on the other hand, the military spokesman did mention that they will also be targeting Hezbollah wherever they want, wherever they can, wherever Hezbollah is present. And this alludes to the fact that they did target Hezbollah in Syria, for example, even before the war. The question here lies is whether if there is a ceasefire, if Hezbollah does stop its operations in South Lebanon once the aggression on Gaza stops, will the Israelis continue by targeting Hezbollah fighters or any target that seems to be military target in South Lebanon, or will they limit that aggression to Syria as they had in the past? So these are questions that are being asked. There's also another factor that has played out newly. We have two members of the Amal movement that have also martyred fell as a result of the operations, and they have also launched an operation in South Lebanon. This is something new. This is a new factor. And so it does seem that if in case there is a wider confrontation, there is a possibility that it is not only Hezbollah that will be facing Israeli aggression or the Israeli possible invasion of South Lebanon. There will also be other factions, whether it is the Amal movement or the Fajr movement, and even perhaps Palestinian resistance factions like Hamas and Islamic Jihad that are working from inside Lebanon.
All right, thank you. Mariam, of course, keeping our eyes on everything very closely. Mariam Saleh, they're out of Beirut. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate has announced a bipartisan agreement to provide $118 billion in aid to U.S. allies, most importantly, the Israeli regime. The multi-billion-dollar deal would provide $14.1 billion in military aid to Tel Aviv and $2.44 billion to address security in the Red Sea, where Yemeni fighters have launched attacks on Israeli-bound commercial ships. Well, the deal has the support of President Joe Biden, who has urged Congress to swiftly pass it. Earlier in November, a Republican plan approved by the House allocated $14.5 billion in military aid for Israel. Well, the U.S. and the U.K. have staged a fresh round of attacks on Yemen amid escalating tensions in the Red Sea over the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. According to Yemeni sources, the strikes hit the southern province of Hodeidah, this hours after the Yemeni deputy foreign minister said his country would continue supporting Palestine despite attacks by the U.S. and Britain. Hossein al-Izdi stressed that Yemeni armed forces will respond to attacks on their soil. Al-Izdi also rejected the U.S.'s claim that the Yemeni strikes are a threat to international shipping, saying that it is the U.S. that has militarized the Red Sea. American and British militaries have performed a spate of joint operations on Yemen since the 11th of January to protect Israel's maritime interests. Well, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi has hailed the country's progress in the face of obstacles. Raisi told the National Conference on Iran's progress and achievements that Tehran has managed to make headway despite all the sanctions and threats. Raisi added that the progress of the country must be seen and shown to the younger generation. He also slammed the enemies of the Islamic Republic for misrepresenting Iran's progress and strength and magnifying its weaknesses. Well, the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has discussed regional developments and bilateral ties with Iraqi officials in Baghdad. In a meeting with Iraq's Prime Minister Mohammad Shia al-Sudani, Ali Akbar Ahmadiyan stressed cementing bilateral relations. Both parties emphasized that any security issue should be resolved within the framework of the comprehensive security agreement signed by Iran and Iraq. Ahmadiyan also expressed gratitude for the courageous stance of the Iraqi government regarding Israel's onslaught on Gaza and Iraq's support for the Palestinian people. In his one-day trip, the Iranian official also met with the Iraqi National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji. They, too, called for further boosting of constructive dialogue. Well, Iran has kicked off nationwide ceremonies marking the 45th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The 10-day celebrations, dubbed the 10 Days of Dawn, is traditionally a time to reflect on the achievements Iran has made thanks to the victory of the revolution. One of the fields in which Iran has made significant progress is nanotechnology. Today, the country ranks among the top five in the world. Gisu Ahmadi brings us more.
Scientists working with special electron microscopes in order to undertake cutting-edge research and product development. This is nanotechnology, the integration of science and engineering on a tiny scale, namely with atoms and molecules. A relatively new field of science and technology with perceived long-term benefits. One that Iran has taken very seriously and today is reaping its rewards. This is all in line with long-term goals and 3-10-year plans to develop nanotechnology in Iran with leader of the Islamic Revolution Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei's full support. But that is not enough. The main strategy of the Islamic Republic of Iran is to benefit from this cutting-edge technology. Therefore, according to officials at the Nanotechnology Development Headquarters, commercializing nano products is an important step and a top priority.
In 2001, which is pretty much the same time that other countries began to engage in nanotechnology development, we established a nanotech headquarters, and in many universities and research centers across the country, scientists started doing research in this field. We started with fewer than 10 scientists, but today there are more than 40,000 researchers and university professors working in this field in more than 150 nanotechnology research centers across the country.
Let me give you some statistics in order to explain what we mean by prioritizing. Right now, as we speak, we have commercialized 1,800 nanoproducts. More than 350 manufacturers have received nanotechnology production permits, and many laboratories are now equipped with or use nanotech devices and products. But the bad news is, in 2022, we sold over $1 billion worth of nanoproducts, and we earned $70 million from exports. Currently, 47 countries, including regional countries such as Iraq and Turkey, import nanoproducts made in Iran.
Advancements in a relatively new field of science, such as nanotechnology, is only one of the many achievements Iran has made after the Islamic Revolution, and definitely one that every single Iranian is proud of.
Over the past two decades, the Islamic Republic of Iran has been able to gain a firm foothold in nanotechnology, today ranking among the world's top five in the field. Yisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
And with that, brings us to the end of this Worldness edition right here. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Epic. Glory. Honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Islamic revolution and economic progresses. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Agriculture is a key section of economy of any country, yet it was in a very poor situation before the Islamic Revolution, especially in the last decade of Pahlavi regime's unholy life. This while the Shah would mendaciously speak of great agricultural reforms in Iran. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, however, people and officials prioritized addressing agriculture seriously. They tried first to provide infrastructures and facilities for villages in a bid to help deprived villagers afford food security. With regards to Iran's semi-dry climate, this goal seemed very hard to materialize. Nevertheless, with sincere endeavor of villagers and application of advanced technologies, the country managed to take agriculture to the present situation, where crops production has increased 5 times and exports have increased 10 times. Iran is currently self-sufficient in 80% of its crops. In the 5th episode of the special series on the 45th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, we are going to dwell upon progresses in agriculture and other sections. Stay tuned, please. According to the statistics of United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the Islamic Republic of Iran ranks 1st to 10th in production of 22 crops all over the world. This is while the rainfall in Iran is 1/3 and the rate of water evaporation is 3 times the global average. But after the Islamic Revolution, there has been a 20% growth in production of horticultural crops. FAO report shows that Iran is the greatest producer of fruits in West Asia. Iran is the first fruit-producing country in the region, and in production of 15 horticultural crops, stands among 10 top countries in the world. In addition, the average fruit consumption in the country is nearly 150 kilograms, which is double the global rate. The Ministry of Agriculture Jihad has announced that the Iranian fruits are exported to over 100 countries. Thus, in spite of the U.S. illegally imposed sanctions and harsh climatic changes, Iran's agriculture has grown dramatically after the revolution, and this has seriously maintained economic security of the nation. Besides agriculture, it should be mentioned that the Islamic Republic has gained great success in animal husbandry, fishery, and meat production. Another field in which the Islamic Republic has made great progress is the field of road construction. While before the Islamic Revolution, Iran's roads grid was too limited and restricted only to big cities, after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, big strides have been taken in construction of qualified and safe roads in cities, towns, and villages. Presently, there are 220,000 kilometers of road in Iran with a significant share of rural roads. The length of freeways has increased more than 40 times after the revolution. Surprisingly, there are more than 20,000 kilometers of highways, which is 550 times more than the pre-revolution era. Iranians own 24 million cars. This puts Iran in the 21st rank globally. As for railroad network, the Islamic Republic has enjoyed 3 times increase compared with the previous regime. In other words, the railroad length has reached 15,000 kilometers. Iran's geographical situation is in a way that it can act as an important corridor to link the east to the west and the south to the north. Several agreements have already been planned and signed, with a few countries on the issue. In the age of communications, the Islamic Republic has broadened infrastructures of network to facilitate and improve national information and knowledge in cyberspace. Approximately all Iranian families have access to telephone line or landline. This is while almost every Iranian youth owns cell phone and a remarkable number of students have laptops for academic purposes. However, while hundreds of satellite channels broadcast programs in Farsi language to tarnish the image of and demonize the Islamic Republic of Iran, 180 national, local, and international channels broadcast programs to induce hope and speak of progresses of the country.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri wa salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. For the last few lectures, we've talked about the different tricks that shaitan uses. And in this lecture, I want to look at how to fight off shaitan. any subject that we've ever gone into depth with, you know, we've looked at it from a full holistic perspective where we talked about all of these things and then how to fix it. But whenever we come to these discussions and how to fix it, it always seems very anticlimactic, you know, because whatever I'm about to tell you of how to fight off shaitan is not something that you don't know already, right? Like, this is something that we've already been told, because if it was a mystery, then we would have some hujjah against God to say, why didn't you tell me about this, right? I'm now 40, you should have told me about this earlier. No, God has already told us these things, right? We just sort of take this as a reminder. So when it comes to seeking the help of God to fight off shaitan, this concept in Islam is known as isti'adha. And so isti'adha is broken up into two parts, right? The first part is to demonstrate our commitment and attachment to Allah. Because isti'adha is attachment to God, right? If I'm saying, oh Allah, I seek your protection, that means I'm seeking refuge with Him. I'm His refugee. Yeah, like I'm seeking your protection, help me. And so I'm submitting to God entirely, right? And that's what isti'adha is. It's an absolute submission to Allah, because it's only Allah who can protect me. And so, number one, the first concept of isti'adha is to demonstrate our commitment. So I have to show God I'm submitting. And we'll talk about the steps of that. And then the second part is to show God that I'm using the weapons you've given me to fight off shaitan. Right? Because that's how it works, isn't it? Right? Like, I can't say to God, protect me, and then I'm going to see like thunderbolts and fire raining down on shaitan. No, Allah said, okay, here, I'm giving you tools. Now fight them. Right? And so I have to then utilize these tools. But so today I want to look at this first one. And again, like I said, these are things that we know. Yeah, these are not new to us. But we just have to be reminded from time to time, because that's what God does. فَذَكِّرْ إِن نَفَعَتِ الذِّكْرَ. Allah says, remind, for there is benefit in reminding. So how do we practically demonstrate to God that we are seeking His protection? So the first thing, number one, is faith. Right? I have to increase my faith in God. And I have to believe that it's only God who can protect me. And this is, I tell you, the solution to 99.9% of our problems. Increase my faith in God, right? Read a book. Study our faith. Truly believe no one else will give. It doesn't matter where we are in life. Our faith can always get better. Always get better. Yeah, like a trick of shaitan would be to say that I'm good with my faith. Because that's when we stop progressing. And shaitan's like, I got him, right? Because he's not trying anymore. And so to constantly remind ourselves of God, and we've talked about this so many times, increasing our faith in God. However we need to increase our faith in God, we increase our faith in God. But this is something that's very powerful, and we've given in the past step by step of how to increase our faith in God. But our sixth imam says in a tradition, قَالَ Iblis, the Iblis says, خَمْسَةٌ لَيْسَ لِي فِيهِنَّ حِيلَةٌ وَسَائِرُ النَّاسِ فِي قَبْضَتِي. This is very, I don't say arrogant on his Iblis's part, but like it's a very powerful statement from him, right? He says, there are five types of people who I cannot grasp, yeah, that I cannot trick. But he says, but the rest of the people are readily in my grasp. I can take them whenever I want. Amazing, right? Like, look at he's not messing around. You know what I mean? Like, he's saying, these five, okay, the rest, I got you, right? Who are these five people? And so we want to talk about how to increase our faith. This will tell us. Who are these five people? He says, one who clings fast to Allah with a true intention and relies solely in Allah in all his affairs. I turn to God. Yeah, I realize that I can't even get up. Bihawlillah, that's a very powerful statement when we recite salah. That I rise with the power of God. Man, this is the life mantra. I cannot do anything without God. Right? I cannot accomplish anything were it not for God. And so there's this mindset that I need Him, I need Him, I need Him. You know, there are times, and this is again something that I am trying to work on consistently. You know, there are times when the stage is bigger, you know? And I'm just giving you my example. There are certain times when the stage is bigger, the lights are brighter, you know? And so I turned to God at that time and said, Allah, I really need you right now, you know? And then a voice says, but don't you need me right after too? Yeah? Don't you need me after that? And don't you need me every moment as bad as you need me right now? And that's so true. See, and when the things are big, like I have an exam, I need you badly. I have an interview, Allah, I need you badly. Yeah, there is this, I need you badly. Like I'm going to apply for a visa, I need you badly. But man, we need Him badly all the time. Yeah, because we can't live without Him. You know what I mean? And so that's the mindset. To change it from only desperation when I need Him badly to actually believe I need Him badly all the time. You feel me? And if we can understand that, it's a game changer. It's an absolute game changer because then I never forget God. He's always there. I need Him badly, right? And so that's the first type of person who Shaitan says, I can't do anything with because they're always with God. The second person, he says, a person who is constantly glorifying Allah day and night. He's in the dhikr of Allah. Again, it's not a tasbih. It's that this person, the dhikrullah in his complete sense, is that this person will never do anything haram. Yeah, they will always be with God. So there's now no time where a shaitan can say like, man, I can come to him right now. No, he'll always be in the dhikr of God. He'll never be anything close to haram. That's the second type of person. The third type of person, he says, he who pleases for his brother in faith whatever he pleases for himself. Yeah, beautiful, right? Like I'm not selfish in my relationships with you. I genuinely wish the best for you. Genuinely. I genuinely wish the best for you, right? And that genuineness, it doesn't come about all the time because in most relationships, we're manipulative. Yeah, and we are, right? Like we're going to manipulate the person to do what is good for me. You know what I mean? And so if we can get past that, Shaitan can't bother us. Number four, one who does not feel anxious when an affliction befalls them. Anxious, right? Subhanallah, like they're cool. They're calm. Something bad happened? I'm with God. Why am I worried? You know what I mean? Like things will work out. That's a very calm person to be around. That's a very nice person to be around. But again, it's not something that is common. We panic very easily. You know what I mean? Like we stress out very easily. And so that's the fourth type of person. And the fifth one, he says, one who is satisfied with whatever Allah has provided for him and does not worry about what's coming later or his sustenance. I'm satisfied. God has given me this. I'm good with it. I will do the best with it as I can. If more is provided, alhamdulillah, right? These five things I think we need to remember because when we talk about how to increase our faith, these are five ways in which we can increase our faith. And when we increase our faith in Allah, the result is I then do isti'adha more purely.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareemun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen Ghafur Shakurun Wadud Qayyum وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The former German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer has admitted recently that Germany has been hit hard economically over the past 2 years, including by the loss of cheap energy. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Bloomberg News Agency has covered this story and tells us more. Replacing Russian gas with liquefied natural gas, LNG, from the United States has exposed the European Union's energy system to major security risks. The United States, which started exporting its shale gas only in 2016, is currently the second biggest gas supplier to the European Union after Norway. In 2023, the United States became the world's top liquefied natural gas LNG exporter. Many European Union countries dramatically increased LNG purchases in 2023, following the drop in pipeline gas flows from Russia due to the Ukraine-related sanctions and the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines in September of 2022, which rendered them inoperable. Ira Joseph, a senior research associate at the Center on Global Energy Policy at Columbia University in New York, said, "European reliance on U.S. liquefied natural gas will only grow if more Russian gas does not reappear and the Qataris decide not to engage in a price war for market share." However, the analyst added that changes in U.S. policy could pose a major risk for Europe. In fact, U.S. President Joe Biden recently ordered a temporary pause on approving pending and future applications for liquefied natural gas exports, citing concerns over climate change. The halt is expected to allow the Department of Energy to update the economic and environmental guidelines it uses when approving new export licenses. The White House had made a pledge to Brussels to quickly review applications for new export capabilities, after the European bloc opted to wean itself off of energy supplies from Russia. According to Fred Hutchinson, president and chief executive officer of LNG Allies, President Biden's announcement does not keep faith with that pledge. Energy Aspects gas analyst David Sadusky believes that the halt will almost certainly be undone if the Republicans retake the White House. David Sadusky said, "This could be a pause for political purposes to appease Biden's base in the run-up to the general election. Or it could be a longer halt to permitting that clamps down on the changes of these terminals being approved longer term." An unnamed senior European Union official told the Bloomberg News Agency that the European Commission is not concerned about the bloc's growing dependency on American liquefied natural gas because there aren't the same levels of political risks as with Russia. However, analysts highlight potential challenges ahead. John T. Shepherd, Vice President of Global Liquefied Natural Gas Trading and Origination at BP, had previously warned that the growing reliance on U.S. gas is creating a concentration risk for the entire sector. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. Dieter Juul Jorgensen, Director General for Energy in the European Commission, said The European Union will have to buy liquefied natural gas from the United States for several decades after the bloc opted to sharply reduce purchases from Russia. According to the energy official, the bloc's reliance on supplies of American liquefied natural gas is expected to persist. Jorgensen added, "We will need some fossil molecules in the system over the coming couple of decades, and in that context, there will be a need for American energy." Brussels is aiming to improve energy security as it shifts away from Russian energy supplies, but is balancing that with ambitious targets to cut carbon emissions by more than a half by 2030. Beyond that, it is aiming to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. According to analysts quoted by the Financial Times, Jorgensen's projections are expected to help clear the path forward for European Union buyers, who are hesitating over whether to sign contracts with United States suppliers beyond 2030. U.S. shipments of liquefied natural gas to the European Union more than doubled in 2022, increasing to 56 billion cubic meters compared to 22 billion cubic meters in 2021. Meanwhile, supplies of Russian natural gas made up only 16% of the EU's gas imports in late 2022. In 2021, Russian gas accounted for about 45% of European Union gas purchases and covered nearly 40% of the bloc's entire consumption. Since the start of the Ukraine war, exports of Russian natural gas to the European Union have seen a sharp decline due to the imposition of Western sanctions on Moscow. The German newspaper, the Augsburger Allgemeine, has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer admitted recently that Germany has been hit hard economically over the past 2 years, including by the loss of cheap Russian energy. A deeper-than-expected slump in Germany's industrial production has affected most industries over the past 2 years due to shortages of raw materials and energy, for which prices have surged. Joschka Fischer explained, "We are in a situation in which we have a huge problem economically, technologically, and in terms of security policy. The cheap Russian gas is gone, and it's not coming back. The large Chinese export market has transformed from an opportunity into a threat. The EU's top economy benefited from cheap Russian energy for over 2 decades. It relied on the sanctioned country for 40% of its gas imports before 2022, making it among the hardest hit by the supply reduction. Given its previous reliance on Russian gas and the importance of cheap energy for its industry-heavy economy, Germany stands out among European Union countries in facing particularly acute difficulties." Recently, the Vice Chancellor and Economy Minister Robert Habeck warned that the German economy had lost its competitive advantage after abandoning Russian gas supplies. Recent statistics showed that Germany is overpaying for current natural gas supplies due to still elevated prices, even though the country has more than halved imports of pipeline gas. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. Inflation across the Eurozone rose in December after an increase in energy costs, reversing 6 months of consecutive falls and easing the pressure on the European Central Bank, the ECB, to cut interest rates. Figures from the European Union statistical agency Eurostat showed consumer prices across the 20-country bloc rose at an annual rate of 2.9% last month, up from 2.4% in November. Economists polled by Reuters news agency had forecast a slightly higher reading of 3% for December. The increase in the headline rate comes after the end of government support for utility costs, alongside a smaller annual decline in energy prices in December than in November, connected to last year's one-off subsidy in Germany. The figures come amid speculation the European Central Bank will begin cutting interest rates within months amid a worsening economic slowdown across the eurozone, having increased borrowing costs to the highest level since the launch of the euro. Financial markets widely expect the world's largest central banks to slash interest rates this year as inflation falls back after the shock from the COVID pandemic and Russia's war with Ukraine, while there are growing fears of recession in several advanced economies. Michael Field, the European market strategist at Morningstar, said, "Some investors will undoubtedly be concerned that this spike in inflation may put the European Central Bank off cutting interest rates sooner rather than later." Michael Field added, "However, central bankers were always aware of the potential for this spike in inflation, thus it shouldn't factor in on their decision-making process. All eyes are on next month's inflation release and whether we can get back to that all-important downward trend." You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The second phase of the revolution. On the occasion of the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, February 11th, 2019. Today, after 40 annual celebrations of the victory of the revolution and 40 Fajr 10 days, one of the two centers of animosity has already perished, and the second one is struggling with predicaments that signal its death in the near future. Whereas the Islamic Revolution is advancing while preserving and adhering to its models. It is possible to assume an expiry date for anything, yet the global mottos of this religious revolution are exceptional. They will never expire, because they match human nature in all eras. Freedom, ethics, spirituality, justice, independence, dignity, rationality, brotherhood are not limited to a single generation or society, so that they would rise in a period and decline in the next. It is impossible to imagine a people who despise these values.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The reported cases of reluctance to these values were due to the officials who had shrunken from these religious values, and not due to their adherence to them and endeavors for achieving them. The Islamic Revolution, like a living and unwavering phenomenon, is always flexible and ready to correct its mistakes, but it is not revisionary or passive. It is positively sensitive to criticisms. It regards them as a divine blessing as well as a warning to those who do not act upon their words. Yet, it by no means takes distance from its values, which are blended with the religious faith of the people, thanks be to God. Since the establishment of the system, the Islamic Revolution has never suffered from and will never suffer from stagnation and recession, and it does not see any conflict and contradiction between revolutionary dynamism and political and social order. Rather, it eternally defends the theory of the revolutionary system. The Islamic Republic is not reactionary, and it does not lack perception and understanding in face of new phenomena and situations. However, it strongly adheres to its principles, and it is highly sensitive to its frontiers in relation to its rivals and enemies.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.